There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of the Motormouth podcast. As part of our tie-up with the Brain Tumour Charity, we'll be doing a few of these spin-off shows with a wide range of people from the motoring world who all, unfortunately, share one thing apart from a love of motorsport, and that is that they've all been affected by a brain tumour in some way. You can check out episode one now, where I share my story and the reason behind our team-up with the charity. But in today's show, I'll be joined by Richard Jones, the planning director for the Williams Formula One team. His job is pivotal to the running of the team and involves setting up and enabling plans to deliver projects on time in full, from rapid in-season developments to a whole new car program. He also sadly lost his sister Eleanor to a brain tumor, and he joins me now. Richard, thank you so much for firstly, you know, giving up your time to talk to me. And it's a difficult issue to discuss, of course, especially in this kind of setting. But we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story. Before we chat about your experience with brain tumour, I think, you know, it's great to get a sense of who you are and what you do every day. And of course, you know, our audience, big motorsport fans, and you've got a very, very important job at Williams as the planning director, which is a huge job, and I suppose people might not actually know exactly what it is. So first of all, why don't we start with, you know, how you got to where you are now? When did motorsport become a thing for you and you thought, actually, you know what, I want to work in Formula One?
Well, thanks very much for having me first, and a huge thanks also for the work you guys are doing to promote the Brain Tumour Charity. I think that's awesome. I guess for me, motorsport, I've got this memory of being age 12 and telling one of my school friends' mums that I was going to work in F1. But I actually don't know where that came from, because I didn't grow up in a F1 family. And so the most vivid memory probably is I had some family friends who were kind enough to take me to Silverstone a few times in my mid-teens. And the race that really sticks out is 98 British Grand Prix, mainly because it was absolutely pouring with rain. And I was standing on a muddy bank.
It's not a British Grand Prix without rain.
Exactly. Standing on a muddy bank at Abbey with water literally pouring down my back. And David Coulthard spun off in front of me. And back in those days, they just left the car on the gravel by the fence. And so I spent probably a good chunk of the race just looking at his car. And then somehow Michael Schumacher won the race by coming into the pits at the end instead of taking a stop-go penalty. So he actually crossed the finish line in the pit lane, won the race. We had no idea what was going on back on our muddy hill. But that memory is so vivid that from then onwards, I've been fascinated by it. That also happened to be France 98 World Cup final day. So it's just one of those epic sporting days. Went back
to
watch France beat Brazil. And you kind of go, right, I want to be in sport. I want to be in motorsport.
Yeah.
here we go.
You want that adrenaline rush somehow, I suppose, don't you? And it's such those, nothing beats those kind of sporting moments, does it?
Absolutely.
I think also recently, I think, was it, you know, when the Olympics, you know, where Super Saturday and stuff like that, that's what reaches moments like that make you go, oh my God, yeah. You know, sport, you just
want
to be involved
on the back
with
of your neck
it.
Moments, don't you?
Exactly. So that's when you sort of first, you know, that poor woman who you said, I'm going to work in F1, yeah. probably didn't know what you were going to end up doing. So, you know, what was your sort of initial steps to being there? I suppose, you know, university or did you go do apprenticeships and things like that?
Yeah. So I assumed that I needed to get in through a technical route. So enjoyed the maths and physics, went down the engineering route, went to uni to do engineering. And actually in my first year, I started writing to F1 teams to try and get work experience. And this is going to make me sound really old, but back in those days, this was proper letters that I wrote.
Yeah.
And the teams were kind enough to actually write back on headed paper. So I had on my wall in my student room all of my rejection letters from all the teams as motivation to keep pushing, keep working hard, keep trying. And then as I went through uni, I realized that there were people that just loved the technical detail way more than I did. So I could do it, but I wasn't fascinated by it. And so I actually ended up kind of accidentally falling into a consultancy who were recruiting engineers to take an engineering approach to how a business works and how to make a business perform better. And it's a really long way around to getting to F1, but actually it was an amazing learning experience because I started in a brick factory. I worked in submarines, worked in sports, retail, food factories, hospitals, and always looking at a business and how it works and working out how to help that team make it work better. And I'd been doing that for about 10 years. Business grew a lot, so a huge experience. But I got to the point where I was either going to be a consultant forever or I should go and work actually in a business. And then I sat down and thought, well, what kind of business do I actually want to work for? Well, it still only is an F1 team. So back to letter writing, I literally look on a map, write a letter to my nearest F1 team, which happens to be Williams. And fortunately, the letter ends up on the right person's desk. Through a series of conversations, I ended up taking a role actually in the advanced engineering business to take learnings from how F1 works and performance in F1 and take that to some of the sponsors and some of the other clients, as well as doing some internal improvement projects. So kind of a mixture of F1 and my previous consulting background. So that kind of got me in touching distance, but not quite there. And then, so I've been doing that for about 3 years, built a small team to do that. And then 2019 season started in F1, which for Williams was bad. So you'll probably remember... or certainly even watching it the second time around on Netflix was even worse.
But
we missed the first day of testing, we missed the second day of testing, and obviously
that's a big impact on a team, isn't it?
Because it's not just missing those days, but that means that you're quite a long way behind in the quantities going to the first races and so on. So I was watching that on the sidelines, but I then got asked to come and be part of the team to review what had happened and what had gone wrong. And that really gave me an opportunity to understand how the F1 team itself worked and to start to make some suggestions. And then through that, I then got asked to come and be part of the solution. So by Claire and Mike. And so kind of a few months later, I then started this role. So as you said, planning director, it basically is the pressure job in that there's this kind of unwritten rule of just don't do 2019 again. We can't be late.
Yes.
But it's this kind of threading the needle of you can't be late, but you also can't be early, because if you're early, then you've left performance development time on the table. And so you're trying to go, cool, we've got 25,000 parts. We haven't designed most of them yet, but we need to somehow predict exactly when we need to start them in order to get them when we need them so that we actually hit the track on the right day.
Yeah. What a journey it's been though since then, because the following year, you know, you had it together.
Yeah. Fortunately. So,
thank God you kept your job.
Massively. Like, genuinely, we could be like, okay, well, if this goes wrong, it's pretty easy to point a finger. And it's been a huge learning curve, but I love it because it's an amazing challenge. So yeah, great place to be, great role.
And it's obviously, you know, that what a great journey, first of all, to getting to Formula One. You know, I suppose that, well, there is no straightforward journey, really. For everybody's got a different path. So from subways to submarines. from subway to Williams. Now, that really would be a journey. Yeah. Thank you for telling me that. But so now looking at, you know, Williams in its current state, obviously it's a team who are trying to rebuild and get back up the grid. Last year with George Russell and Nicholas Latifi, that was a much stronger year than 2019. What are you looking for and hoping for 2021? You know, we're recording this in February, so pre-season testing just around the corner. And actually, Williams, you've just done your shakedown of the new car yesterday as we record this. So that's, you know, good signs. The car's ready to go, I suppose. So what happens now ahead of pre-season testing, and what are you looking for this season?
Yeah, so I guess yesterday is another relief point for me, because that was the plan to do shakedown yesterday. Yeah. So the fact that that's actually happened and gone really smoothly is great. Looking back at last year, we made huge progress. So it's so unfortunate that we didn't actually score points in the end, because we didn't really get the recognition for the huge step forward that the team had made, both on track but off track as well. And actually, in some ways, I'm even more proud of how the team responded to all of the challenges, both with COVID, but also the change of ownership, change of leadership, a crazy year for us. So for this year, it is just about keeping that momentum of improving. Like, we're pretty realistic about how far you can, or how fast you can develop where you sit in the field relative to everybody else, when everybody else is trying to improve too. But it's about...
obviously for this year, you know, there's a bit of a freeze on most of the regulations ahead of the big change for 2022. So I suppose, is there really that much you can do?
Yeah, there's still quite a bit.
That's
still quite a bit. And I guess we're challenging ourselves because we want to keep pushing all the way through, because we feel like if we keep pushing, we're going to keep developing as a team. That's going to help us long run. So it's definitely not ignore this year, just look at next year. It's much more keep developing ourselves as a team. And then hopefully we make progress, and then keep making progress.
And so what does a typical day involve for you? You know, is it 9 to 5? Is it early morning, late night? Is it work till the job is done? And, you know, how does a typical Monday to Friday work for you?
I guess typical, like right now I'm in the homeschooling juggle. So I'm literally...
So typical is the wrong word, really, isn't it?
Sharing homeschooling with my wife. So that's not typical. So if we ignore that... it's kind of easiest to describe it by the different things that I'm involved with, because I'll go from a meeting, which is about what parts we've got or shortages we've got right now for the next event. We haven't got enough of these things because we had the same accident 2 weeks in a row. Now what are we going to do? Type meetings. To then looking at the exciting bit, which is the upgrades coming. So we're doing a load of development. Here we can see we can get some more performance on the car. Part of my job is, how do we get that on the car quicker? Because the sooner we get it, the better. But then we're also obviously looking ahead at the next car. So I can jump from a meeting about this weekend to a meeting about the start of next year and what order of play we're going to be doing things in. I'm then also involved in how the overall team works. So I guess a couple of the key things. One is young talents. I'm heavily involved in grad schemes. So getting involved in recruitment and development of those people, which I really enjoy. Mm-hmm. But then how business systems work and what we can improve. And then my own team. So we've only been in existence for less than 2 years. So we're just developing as fast as we can. So that feels like a really fun, almost kind of startup environment, trying to work out how we do what we do and make it better all the time. But then there's also the welfare of all those people, because people are working from home, sometimes in the office, all the COVID testing and so on. So just making sure that everybody's okay has become quite a big part of the world, because you just don't see people in the way that you used to.
I was going to say, I suppose your job is pretty essential, especially, and I think sports have elite sports have certain get outs from all the COVID restrictions. Are you able to go in much as you were before? Is it relatively straightforward in terms of actually visiting and working in the factory?
Yeah, because we're a manufacturing business and an elite sport team. So the factory's open, because we obviously need to be able to make parts. Yeah. So then we have a testing regime on site. So we're testing everybody every week, because we need to keep the factory running. And then for people that are involved in, like at the moment, we're obviously making and building cars. So that involves most people. So we've just had to get the testing in place to make sure we're okay to keep going.
Well, fingers crossed for 2021 and you know, for, I suppose, Formula general. You know, we're hoping for a much more straightforward season, and that I'm sure will help you massively, considering how well, as you said, you managed to juggle everything from last year, from, you know, rebuilding the team to being more competitive, as well as the, obviously the owner change and dealing with all the COVID restrictions as well. I think and you're right, actually, although everyone said that, you know, it was a really good improvement for Williams, I suppose it was kind of masked a bit by the fact that, you know, didn't quite get the points so close so many times, yeah. But also with everything else going on. But I think 2021 will have Motormouth will be fully behind you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, that's a bit about you and your role in motorsport and Williams. Now, obviously, we're teaming up with the Brain Tumor Charity here, and we, you know, we've got this association with them, and it's all about people working in motorsport who have, unfortunately, this connection with brain tumors. So tell me a bit about your sister, Eleanor, who you sadly lost to a brain tumor, and what she was like as a person.
Yeah, sure. So she was Eleanor to some of us, Ellie, Els. She's one of those people that is just full of energy, laughter, kind of chasing fun, always up for trying different things, particularly live music, different sports. And she just made a huge number of friends along the way. Really bubbly person. One of the things I thought about shortly after she had died was, if she knew she only had 36 years, would she have done it differently? And I just don't think she would have. Like, she was the sort of person that prioritized doing things that she enjoyed. She made the most of every opportunity. And that's something I've really reflected on, because I think we can all learn something from that kind of approach to life.
Definitely. I think if one thing this kind of diagnosis does to you and the people around the person who's being diagnosed, is you realize, you know, how short life is, don't you? And how much we take for granted.
Yeah. You just don't imagine people disappearing like that. So you've just got to make the most of everything you can.
Was she into Formula One? Was she quite enjoying your path towards it, or your love for it?
I'd say interested, intrigued, but not passionate. wanted to find out more about it. Came with us to qualifying actually while she was undergoing her treatment. So like, just being around live events was her thing, just the buzz from that kind of thing. So
now, of course, I suppose not knowing much about the prognosis and disease, because the one thing I often find that, you know, when my mum was diagnosed with a glioblastoma, which is the same as what your sister was diagnosed with, you know, I suppose I'm lucky in a way that my dad is a neurosurgeon and my mum was a nurse. So I come from a very medical family who, you know, specialized in brains. So that, you know, if I had any questions, they could be answered quite quickly and quite readily. But also I had, I suppose, I was able to be a bit blissfully naive, I suppose, because I didn't have to worry too much, because I knew that whatever my dad was doing was probably the right way to do things. And I didn't have to, you know, interfere or get too much on top of the subject, because, I mean, it's something a little bit I regret personally, but I think you do have a bit of that blissful naivety if you don't want to know the full reality of it sometimes, if you can spare yourself. So how did you deal initially with the diagnosis of the disease? How did you make yourself more aware of it? How did you deal with that, those awful conversations that you have to have?
So I guess the first situation was my sister. We were actually all at my parents' house because it was their wedding anniversary weekend, and she was having terrible headaches. And we were like so naive about the existence of brain tumors that it was almost like, oh, wow, I wonder if I've got a brain tumor because my headache's so bad. Just a complete throwaway comment, no one really thinking anything of it. But from that, my sister went to see the doctor, got a scan, and a few days later I was traveling into London to go with her to meet the consultant surgeon to review the results of the scan. And she had, they'd already given her steroids by that stage to try to reduce the swelling. Steroids had a pretty big impact on her, as in she'd just gone a bit loopy, to be honest. So we're in with the consultant and it was like, right, I need to understand this because I'm the one that's going to actually be taking this in. She's partly in shock. She's partly high on steroids. So I've got to get this, work out what the hell's going on. And then just because I was in that first meeting, I then became the person that went to the consultancy appointments, a kind of family representative. So understanding it, debriefing sessions with her, and then kind of passing on a briefing to family and friends, almost became a role, I guess. And I didn't, as you said, I didn't know anything, which is the complete opposite of you guys' situation. So going into those meetings and then asking loads of questions to try and understand it, but then also referring to actually the Brain Tumor Charity website is brilliant because there's a huge amount of material on there. So you end up researching through there, giving me prompts of questions to ask and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And feeling my way through it.
It's so, especially with the website, it's so easy as well when you go on it and it has those big three bits. Do you have a brain tumor? Do you know someone with a brain tumor? Have you got, any? And it's just, it takes that unnecessary stress away because it's already a huge situation to deal with. So to finding out the information, you just want that to be as simple as possible, don't you?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So it was brilliant that they were able to help you through that. And then were you able to sort of using that information and were you able to get, the answers you needed and able to take those next steps going forward? What kind of treatment was she going to go through?
So she had surgery very, very quickly. Then we went into radiotherapy and chemotherapy course. And I guess over time, you get into this cycle of you're waiting for a scan to see if the treatment that you're having has an impact. And then at a stage a bit later, we ended up as a result of scan needing to change to a different chemo. Mm. So all the way through that, we're having meetings, understanding what the consultant's seeing, what the consultants think is going on. And I became really conscious that when we went for a debrief over a coffee afterwards, how I communicated my interpretation of how the meeting had gone impacted her mindset significantly. And so we talk quite a lot about kind of trusting the process, trusting the experts and not worrying about the outcome. And they're kind of trying to have the belief that if we do what they want us to do in the right way and we understand it in the right way, and we just keep focusing on the next step of the process, whatever the next bit of treatment is, that's going to be the right journey to getting through this. And so as you go along, you're kind of understanding what the treatment is, what it might do, understanding the side effects and just helping her to manage each stage of the process, but actually never to look too far ahead because I didn't really want to know where it could go. I wanted to know that this bit was going to work.
Yeah, I think that's all too common for especially this kind of, because there are lots of different brain tumors, of course, but a glioblastoma is obviously very common amongst adults as well in particular, but the outcome is just so bleak currently. And, I think today I saw in the news that they've made a little breakthrough in terms of how they treat the cells for a glioblastoma, but it's still one that where the outcome is, you it's the same process for everybody over and over again. You have the chemo, you wait and check for the scan, and then you do a different version. And fortunately, that's just the way it goes, and it becomes a bit of a horrible Groundhog Day, doesn't it? Yeah. Every month or so. Yeah. How, if at all, did you cope? Because you were enjoying, as we discussed at the start of the show, such highs in your professional life, making huge waves towards, your dream job, I suppose, working for one of the biggest Formula One teams, one of the biggest British Formula One teams in history. Dealing with that and also then balancing with such personal lows. How, if at all, did you manage that?
So firstly, I guess I've never thought about the career stuff being a high yet. I feel like I've got this opportunity to take on this challenge with a great bunch of people, but I'm right at the beginning of it. So the high is going to come later, I'm hoping. the initial diagnosis for my sister was almost exactly the same time as the verbal job offer to come and work in F1. And so it really felt like I just had two massive challenges at exactly the same time, a work one and a personal one. And in a weird way, there's some parallels between them because it's a really steep learning curve. It's a different language that people are talking to you in. It's really, really complicated. But actually, they're the bits that I was kind of trained to work in from all the consultancy background of going into different environments. So I could treat the hospital meetings a bit like a work meeting where I go in, I need to try and understand what's going on, understand what the next steps are. But then that flipped completely when you walk out of the meeting and then it's me and my sister and it's her reality that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And you're sitting down over a coffee and trying to kind of process it. And we'd work through that. Then it's on the train home when I'm just digesting it all. But then it obviously massively helps to flip back to the other challenge of into work mode because shit, I've got to plan this car and I don't really understand what I'm doing yet. So I think
did that help?
Yeah, because I was just so busy.
Yeah, but I mean, that I think I'm glad you said that, because I think it must be a common thing. But I threw myself into doing work and trying to just anything, yeah. Any chance that I had, it would be, I'd probably be working and trying to make something happen, you know, working in motorsport, working, you know, my way up as well in on the broadcast side, you chuck just as much at it, and it helped so much with that. And it's interesting you say, you know, enjoying the highs. I suppose no matter what the highs, I found that even for a birthday or getting, you know, a meeting with somebody or you really want to get, everything was just dulled.
Yeah,
it didn't matter that much. And although it was in my head, I was like, this is brilliant, found it very difficult to celebrate anything. And I still do a little bit. I don't think that I've probably, you know, it goes perhaps over time, but you know, I'm 2 years on now. It's still, you know, I don't particularly like celebrating, you know, birthdays and stuff like that, because it's such a big reminder of who's missing.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It is like dulling, it is a good description. You just like head down, smashing on with it. Try to do the best you can.
Yeah. How do you manage? Do you manage now? You know, is it still very much you just sort of trying getting on with a regular day, and your job is busy enough? Is it just carrying on and keeping busy and with your own family and work as well? Or have you been able to talk to anybody else? I did a bit of therapy. I didn't do much of it, but, you know, talking to someone did help initially. But again, you know, it's everyone's different.
So I guess the first bit of context is that because of COVID, we haven't actually had a memorial service yet. So we were able
That's
to have
tough.
A like really small funeral with just five of us and my other sister on FaceTime from Australia at the time. But we're still waiting to be able to give her the send off with all of her friends and wider family.
Yeah.
In terms of me personally, I didn't know what normal grief was. So I guess in some ways I was like waiting for it to hit me. And then I knew of a model, you may have come across the Kubler-Ross model, which is like the five stages of grief. Okay. So I actually knew of it from back in consulting world, because in business, you use it as a guidance on what happens when an organization is going through major change. And it's actually really similar stages. So I'd come across it there. And so I looked it up again, and because I'm an engineer, I was like, right, this is how I'm feeling today. So I can look at where that is on this model. And then that's going to tell me how I'm doing through my grief. And then what's going to happen next. And I look at it and it's like, no, that doesn't make any sense, because I'm not there. But sometimes
it's not logical.
It's not. And then I happened to listen to a podcast that Natalie Pinkham did with a bereavement counselor called Julia Samuel. And she did it in tribute to Caroline Flack.
And of course.
And Julia talked all about the different stages of grief. And it kind of made me realize that you can feel any one of those stages on any given day, sometimes multiple in the same day. You don't know what's going to trigger it, but that is what normal grief is. And that's completely okay. And so to start to get used to the fact that different triggers would make me feel different things and accept that that happened, I guess over time, and I'm still totally on this journey, but trying to transition more of the time that when she turns up or something's triggered her turning up, that becomes a positive. It's a happy memory, so that you get kind of used to the feeling and you turn it into the happy feeling. And yeah, I'm working on it. It's a work in progress, as I'm sure.
I think what you said there, I think I'm still very much working on that. You know, I get annoyed at myself when, because I suppose the most recent memories I have of my mum are when I almost say it wasn't fully my mum, because of what this kind of, you know, brain tumor does to somebody, you know, depending, you know, the obviously it varies from person to person, but it very much changed who my mum was as a person, because of course when you have chemotherapy, when you have two brain surgeries, radiotherapy, countless amounts of drugs and the steroids, you know, she changed not just physically but also you know, within herself as well. And that was difficult to process, and those memories are still with me. So I'm working on trying to, as much as, you know, we had some, you know, treasured time together in those last couple of months, but also at the same time, I want to remember more of what happened before all of it, which I very much struggle to do still. And turning these, when she does crop up, as you say, I like that feeling when she turns up, of turning it into a happy feeling. So I think, you know, as you say, grief is different for everybody, and it doesn't have to happen in a particular logical order either. And one thing I noticed is, with this kind of disease, obviously a terminal disease, you start to experience grief before it's even happened, before someone's even died. And I didn't realize that was a thing. I just thought it was, you know, I feel like shit. So, you know, it's probably because this is, yeah. it's probably because this is happening. And then I looked at exactly that model, the Kubler-Ross model.
Yeah.
And I listened to a great podcast by Carrie Ad Lloyd, the Griefcast. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. And that actually got me through it a lot, hearing other people talk about death. I would, if anybody's struggling with their grief, it's funny, it's sad, it's brilliant, it's done so well. So listening to that really helped me through it. But actually, you start to experience those five stages of grief long before actually someone's passed away. And actually realizing that, it's very difficult to actually realize that you're doing that because she's still there.
Yeah, I definitely so, didn't. It's all in hindsight that you look back at the denial phase and you're like, oh yeah, okay.
You mentioned you've done some of your own charity work as well for raising some money for the Brain Tumor Charity. Talk us through a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So we did one of the Twilight Walks a few months into Earl's treatment, and that was myself, my wife, kids, and parents. And I guess until that point, we hadn't known really anybody else going through this kind of thing. So to turn up in this sports hall in Windsor and it just be full of people who are all experiencing or have experienced a brain tumor, and then go on this walk around Windsor and all of the energy and support was an amazing feeling, actually, as much as it was to try to fundraise for the charity. We also then did, so a couple of months after she died, we were obviously stuck at home in lockdown world. So Gemma and I decided that we would take on this challenge to, this is going to sound completely ridiculous, but climb the height of Everest by climbing the steps from our driveway to our front door, which we ended up having to climb 2,322 times over the course of 8 weeks. I mean, it was so dull.
That is brilliant, though.
But it's the kind of thing you can do in lockdown. And it was, again, it was like, I want to do something to help. I want to raise some money. And people definitely got behind us with that. So yeah, anything we can do to help.
That's brilliant. And actually, grief in lockdown especially it must be completely different, especially because although I think you never stop grieving, it just becomes something you learn to live with. But when you know your sister passed, you know, relatively, you know, recently in the grand scheme of things, when you think, consider, you know, can you believe lockdown's nearly been a year as well? Yeah. How has that been with lockdown? Do you think it must be harder?
Really, really weird, because probably the hardest thing I found is that at the point at which you want to be closest to your family, and I've got another brother, sister who's in Australia and parents, the point you want to just be with them, you can't. So we've been through this whole period of time kind of talking to each other on Zoom and trying to support each other that way. But that's the point where you want to be able to support each other and just give each other hugs the most. So that's hurt. I mean, I'm lucky here in that Gemma was really good friends with Els, and then I guess for the two of us to be sharing happy memories with our young children actually helps both of us to be telling happy stories.
I bet. So
we've kind of been here as a unit to get through it, but yeah, it certainly impacted us as a wider family.
I can understand. I've just had I've got three older brothers, and two of them have just had babies, one in December, one in January. So I've got a niece and a nephew, and I've only been able to see one of them. I haven't actually met the other one yet, obviously due to lockdown, but I can't wait till they're old enough. You know, it kills me that they'll never know their grandma, but also I can't wait to sort of be able to tell them, you know, funny stories or for them to pick up traits that, you know, like run down through the family and stuff like that. So it's those little moments, I think, that we kind of have to hold on to.
We're so lucky to have FaceTime, Zoom equivalents, aren't we?
Well, thank God.
Same situation for us, where I've got a new nephew, but he's in Australia, and you just want to like meet this kid. At least we can actually see them and kind of try to.
Yeah, God, I do think sometimes, God, can you imagine if it was just still the, you know, the years where everyone had a Nokia 3310, and you know, no way of doing this. But look, it's there's no easy way around it. It's tough. Everyone experiences it. Everyone goes through it a different way. But Richard, thank you so much for talking to me about Ellie, Els, Eleanor. She sounds sounds like, as you say, an amazing, bubbly personality. And it is a tragedy, as it is with everybody who goes through particularly a brain tumor. And it's great to hear that, you know, obviously the charity who we've teamed up with helped you through it and are doing their job in guiding people through such a difficult, bleak process. And, you know, the more we talk about it, the more awareness we can make of it. And hopefully, you know, that will lead to more funding, more research and to curing, you know, not just this particular glioblastoma brain tumor, but all of them. So Richard, thank you so much for talking to us on Motormouth for this special episode. We're also going to be doing a big charity karting event later in the year, something to look forward to when we can all break out of COVID. You know, we've got big stars. Mark Webber's going to be there, Karun Chandok. We've got James Hunt's Hesketh, and it's going to be a charity karting day. Members of the public can go up against celebs, and it's all in aid, of course, for the brain tumor charity. So Richard, we'd love to see you there. And if you're listening, you want to come along, all the details are at motormouth.club as well. Richard, thank you so much.
No, thank you. I'm definitely going to be at the karting event. Get my helmet.
Yes.
Out. Yeah, absolutely love it. But no, seriously, thank you so much for doing this series, because I think anything we can do to raise the awareness of what the charity is doing is amazing. I know we both want it to happen, but the support and the effort you're putting is awesome. So thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to talk through it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. If you've been affected by a brain tumour and don't know where to turn, head to the braintumorcharity.org website where you can find all the information you need. If you can, you can also donate direct to the charity from our website, motormouth.club, or straight from the Brain Tumour Charity website too. If you can't donate but want to help, there are so many ways to do so by simply sharing this far and wide. You can also sign up to be a volunteer and help support those affected from wherever you are, as well as doing your own fundraising. A cure can't wait. And remember, if you need any more help, the charity is here anytime. You can call them in the UK on 0808 800 0004.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.